Hello, everybody. Bill Buckmaster with you, along with my buddy John, engineering and producing our program on the other side of the glass. We are off and running on the first day of spring. It's Monday, March 20th, 2023. Our radio show now in its 13th year. We're in the Green Thing, Zocalo Village Studio. The radio station is 1030. KVOI, The Voice for Trusted News and Talk. We have our worldwide live listening. That means you can hear our program anywhere in the world by logging into buckmastershow.com. When we do our telephone interviews, that is sponsored by Rincon Ventures Real Estate and Property Management. It's time for our Monday one-on-one, presented by Moe's Gallery and Fine Framing, family-owned and run since 1985. Moe and his great family specialize in custom frame mirrors, art for your walls, picture framing and hanging services and hanging systems. That means Moe and the team will come out to your home and they'll make sure that the art goes up on the wall the way you want it. Moe's Gallery and Fine Framing, Fort Lowell and Dodge, right next to Copenhagen. And their website's looking really good. They did a revision on that, moesgallery.com. This week's one-on-one interview, University of Arizona sociologist Dr. Jennifer Carlson, winner of the prestigious 2022 MacArthur Fellowship for her work examining gun politics, culture, and trauma in the United States. Dr. Carlson is an associate professor in the School of Sociology and the School of Government and Public Policy in the College of Social and Behavioral Sciences. She has spent over a decade examining the politics of guns in American life through research with gun owners, gun sellers, law enforcement, gun violence survivors, and state licensing bodies. Dr. Carlson investigates the forces of the gun culture in the United States. She's got two books published, a third coming. The first book was titled Citizen Protectors, The Everyday Politics of Guns in the Age of Decline. That came out in 2015. The second book, Policing the Second Amendment, Guns, Law Enforcement, and the Politics of Race. That came out in 2020, and the new book will be titled and is titled Merchants of the Right, Gun Sellers and the Crisis of American Democracy. Dr. Carlson, good to see you. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me here today.
Congratulations. The MacArthur Fellowship is not an easy task. It came out of the blue. You got a call.
Yeah, it's a task, but it's not a task you can try for because you can't apply for it. So yeah, I got a call out of the blue, and it was definitely one of the most shocking phone calls I've answered.
It's a big payday. It's spread out over like 5 years, and you can use the money as you wish, or how does that work?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
You teach and enjoy teaching. You were telling me before we went on, the name of your course is Guns in America. Now, does this draw kind of a cross-section of people in the whole gun debate?
Yeah. So I teach a course, as you mentioned, Guns in America at the University of Arizona. And, you know, even though there's kind of stereotypes about universities as liberal institutions, one of the things I really love about teaching at the U of A and teaching this specific course is that I get students, undergraduates from across the political spectrum on this issue. So I have students that own guns and carry them. I have students who are gun violence survivors. I have students that very much identify with Generation Lockdown, really across the board. And so the reason I love this course is it's not about, you know, trying to get students to think one way or another, but really the course is designed around a really simple question, which is, can we have a better gun debate? Can we have a debate where we can sit in the same room and have a conversation and maybe not agree with each other, but at least hear each other and have a conversation? So that is, that's kind of the objective of the course. And so actually the finale of the course is they are required to, for their final paper, interview someone that they think disagrees with them on some aspect of guns. So it can be their, you know, pro-gun rights, and they interview someone who's really in favor of gun control, or, you know, there's many ways to take that. And yeah, they have to answer this question of, can, based on this conversation, what are the, prospects for having a more productive debate about this in American society. So yeah, it's a real joy to teach that class.
It seems like that's kind of the foundation of your work, isn't it? Kind of trying to find this middle ground and getting people to talk about it.
Yeah.
In the same room.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think so much of my work is geared at trying to understand, trying to translate, trying to find sort of the nooks and crannies of this debate that when we kind of unearth those, we actually find, different histories, different kinds of people than, you know, are stereotypically associated with one side or the other side of the gun debate. And, you know, the more we can sort of, you know, whether it's finding middle ground or just finding people who buck the stereotypes, I think that's how we move forward in terms of the debate.
You would think, Dr. Carlson, that sociologists, those in your profession, would be lining up to get involved in this particular topic because it's fertile ground, but really they've shied away from this. Why did you decide to go into it?
Yeah, it's really interesting because this is a topic that is so threaded throughout American society, through American history. You can study almost anything through the lens of guns in America. So it's really, it's really fertile ground. But as you mentioned, when I started thinking about my dissertation topic, I realized very quickly that there were not a lot of sociologists who are supposed to be experts in society studying something so prevalent and crucial and integrated throughout U.S. society. And so, you know, I think there's a personal biography, there's the intellectual biography. I was definitely... I grew up in a pretty conservative family. I did not grow up with guns, though. And so I think in some ways, this was a way to sort of work through my family history in some ways, but kind of at an arm's distance because, like I said, I didn't grow up with guns. But also, I was fascinated just intellectually and politically by, you know, when Obama got elected, you know, before he even stepped into office, there was just, you know, this massive surge in purchasing guns, purchasing ammo. And, you know, I was pretty much a kid still under Clinton. And so I didn't really, you know, I felt it in my household, I guess, you know, my family growing up, because as I said, it was a very conservative family growing up. But I didn't really see it, you know, until that election. And also when I started digging, I started hearing about, you know, these different groups that like the Pink Pistols that kind of, buck the stereotypes of, you know, what gun ownership was all about. So I was like, wow, I bet sociologists have a lot to say about this. I realized that they didn't. And so I packed my bags and I moved to Michigan to study gun carriers, NRA instructors, the politics of what it means to conceal carry and open carry. And so that was what would become my first book.
What has surprised you the most about studying guns in America?
Oh, that's a really great question. I mean, I think there's different things. I think the answer is that there is so much that this issue connects to. So, you know, I think there's a tendency to see the politics of guns and kind of have this like stylized, like pro-gun, anti-gun. It's this angry debate. But when you actually talk to people who are gun owners, like the people who bought guns in 2020 and 2021, you know, by all accounts, there were more women, racialized minorities, members of the LGBTQ community, even liberals who were buying guns. And you realize very quickly when you actually talk to not the talking heads, but everyday people, that, you know, it's more complicated, it's more nuanced. People are often, you know, there's like, you know, the gun seller I interviewed who was like, let me tell you about why I support, you know, universal background checks, or, you know, a gun violence survivor I interviewed who actually was also a concealed carrier. So people who are navigating this space that doesn't, that we don't hear about when we just listen to the big voices that sort of suck out the oxygen in the room on this debate. So.
Well, we're going to pause right here and talk about my favorite bakery in town. Talk about Mona's Danish Bakery, home of the Danish Kringle. Mona's located northeast corner of Swan and Sunrise. I love their croissants. I had a almond croissant over the weekend, and the thing was the size of a frisbee. I mean, it was like, I thought I'll just cut it in half and return to it the next morning. Well, it was so good, I ate the whole thing. Anyway, Mona's is open right now for lunch, northeast corner of Swan and Sunrise. Well, no, they are not open for lunch. It's Monday. They take Monday off. They're open 6:30 Tuesday through Saturday, and then 7 o'clock on Sunday morning. They take that well-deserved day off on Monday. Their website, though, is open for sure, monasdanishbakery.com. More on our one-on-one, our Monday one-on-one with Dr. Jennifer Carlson, talking about gun politics, American gun culture. We'll have more with her in our one-on-one presented by Moe's Gallery and Fine Framing, Fort Lowell and Dodge. Be right back. Family-owned Jam Culinary Concepts and its family of restaurants has you covered for your special event. Jam caters anytime, anywhere, any size group, and any type of cuisine. Vero Amore, authentic Neapolitan pizza, and Noble Hops. Craft beer and fine fare are synonymous with quality. Call 954-1468 or log on to jamculinaryconcepts.com.
The Regional Transportation Authority's 20-year plan includes roadway, transit, pedestrian, bicycle, and many other transportation improvements across the region. Pima County voters approved the plan in 2006, and the RTA is working with the Citizens Advisory Committee to prepare and present a new draft plan as early as 2023 for public review. Learn more about the process at rtanext.com.
Buckmaster Show listeners know that I'm passionate about travel. When I'm ready to take off on a new adventure, my air travel begins and ends at Tucson International Airport. TUS is nonstop for our community and Southern Arizona. So remember, to fly local, fly Tucson. Tucson International is nonstop for Tucson. More at flytucson.com.
The nonprofit Tucson Wildlife Center has been helping injured, sick, and orphan wildlife in Southern Arizona since 1999. They're dedicated to the rescue, medical care, and rehabilitation of sick, injured, and orphan wildlife, with the goal of releasing them back to their natural habitat. Around 5,000 animals a year come to them, as they are the only wildlife rescue in Southern Arizona. All made possible through donations. They receive no government funding. Please donate at TucsonWildlife.com.
This is Bill Buckmaster urging my listeners to join me in becoming a member of the Reed Park Zoo, one of America's top zoos and home to more than 300 animals from all over the world. When you become a zoo member, you receive free daytime admission, discounts on special events and education programs, and so much more. Find out more about zoo membership and everything you need to know about your zoo visit, reedparkzoo.org.
For more than a half century, Tucson Gardeners Trust Green Things, a family-owned and operated retail and wholesale plant nursery, offering an amazing variety of plants, trees, cacti, pottery, and so much more, all at great prices. The 13.5-acre site by the Rito River is also home to the Zocalo Village, specializing in fine Mexican and Latin American imported furniture and art. Green Things open daily at 3384 East River Road and at greenthingsaz.com and zocalovillage.com.
Family-owned and run since 1985, Moe's Gallery and Fine Framing is the gold standard for quality and professionalism for picture framing, custom frame mirrors, art for your walls, and hanging and lighting solutions. Come in for your design session or set it up electronically. Moe's Gallery and Fine Framing, Fort Lowell and Dodge, and now doing e-commerce at moesgallery.com.
This is John Trout. Start your day well-informed and join me for America in the Morning, weekday mornings at 5 before Wake Up Tucson on 1030 KVOI, The Voice.
Welcome back. It is the Buckmaster Show on this first day of spring. This is our Monday one-on-one, University of Arizona sociologist Dr. Jennifer Carlson, winner of the prestigious 2022 MacArthur Fellowship for her work examining gun culture, politics, and trauma in the United States. There's just so much to cover here in a very short amount of time. She also teaches a course titled Guns in America at the University of Arizona, author of three books on this topic. So when it comes to suicide by firearm, that is the leading cause of gun violence, isn't it, in this country?
Yeah, so that's been, for years, suicide has actually been the bulk of gun deaths in the U.S. In Arizona, the latest stats that I've seen are that around 70%, I believe, of gun deaths in Arizona are suicides. What's changed in the last few years with the surge in gun crime since 2020, since the pandemic, is that homicide rates have actually started to catch up. So we're actually seeing gun homicide increasing. That was the big headline story in terms of gun violence increasing in the U.S. over the last few years. It actually wasn't gun suicide. So it is historically gun suicides are the bulk, but that it seems it could be shifting as these rates of gun crime are increasing.
I've interviewed a bunch of law enforcement folks on this topic as recently as a week ago. We had the police chief on the show. I think they're scratching their heads about how all of this during the pandemic, why gun violence just kind of took off. I don't know if people, what's your take on it? You know, there's been a lot of talk. Maybe everybody was, they were angry. And I know that in 2022, there were over 550 road rage gun deaths in this country. What's your take?
Yeah, that's a question that not only law enforcement but criminologists and sociologists are trying to ask. You know, what is going on with this increase in gun deaths and gun violence? You know, and there's a lot to unpack there. I think that people, you know, given that there was this massive surge in 2020 and into 2021 of gun purchasing, of first-time gun owners, of people who had never owned a gun before. You know, that's often been pointed at as, you know, there's something going on there. And so then, of course, the question is, what's the mechanism? And so, you know, one of the arguments is that there has been, you know, more gun theft and that is channeling these, you know, guns that are now in circulation after this surge into, you know, into crime channels. So this research is still really new. So, you know, criminologists, you know, they talk in terms of decades. They don't talk in terms of, you know, week to week trends. So that's being worked out. And then I think there's also just the reality that, you know, when we look at the conditions for violence and when we look at the conditions for gun violence, you know, socioeconomic insecurity, a lack of social safety net, all of these things are related to crime and violence. They are also the reason why people turn to guns, legal owners, because you know, I and this is a quote I often go back to. One of the gun sellers I actually interviewed in 2020, I interviewed 50 gun sellers across the U.S. in 2020 while this surge was happening. And one of the gun sellers that I interviewed, just to paraphrase him, you know, he said, I was asking, like, well, how do you explain this surge? How do you explain, you know, because some of the gun sellers would even say things like, you know, don't they know they can't shoot a virus? Like, they were also scratching their heads. And this one gun seller said, you know, in the U.S., you don't have many guarantees. The only guarantee you have is the Second Amendment, and that's why people are turning to guns. And I think that is so profound because it tells us that, you know, that is not just, you know, it's about so much more than like gun politics. It's about trying to find a sense of safety and security. And I think that is that lack of safety, sense of safety and security is both what makes guns so appealing, but is also, if we look at, you know, just the big explanations for how gun violence happens, it's also the context in which gun violence can occur.
All right. We're speaking with Jennifer Carlson. Dr. Carlson, a MacArthur Fellow. Let's talk a little bit about, because we are quickly running out of time, the future of gun politics in the United States, and do you see an avenue that might be promising to address this area?
Yeah, it's super fascinating in this moment because on the one hand, you have a bipartisan gun policy passed and signed into law by Biden. And this is something that, you know, it's been quite a long time since there's been bipartisan movement on, you know, gun laws and gun regulations. And then in the same moment, you have Bruin, this Supreme Court decision that basically it's all about gun carry, but basically making it so that the more restricted regimes of New York, California, Maryland, that those are not constitutional as they stand, and that they have to maybe not go to the extent of looking like Arizona's, but look more like Arizona than they would for that Supreme Court decision. So it's interesting that there's these different movements happening in different arms of even the federal government. I think that what's interesting about the package that was signed into law by Biden is that in some ways it doesn't look quite like what people imagine when they hear the words gun control. I mean, yes, there's tightening of background checks. There's certain things like that, but there's also provisions like funding community violence intervention initiatives. And so these, I think, are really promising because these are basically, these are programs that are run very much at a grassroots level. There's a great documentary film called The Interrupters that is about violence intervention programs in Chicago. And what that documentary shows, it basically profiles a group of people. They're mostly people who have served time, who may have had former gang affiliations. And what they do is actually they literally work the streets, and they de-escalate. They mentor, they de-escalate situations that could erupt into violence. They literally put themselves in some cases in the line of fire. And, you know, in some ways, they are doing the hard work that I think a lot of times conversations about gun policy avoid. We want to pass laws and pass sweeping changes, but we also have to change ourselves and our culture and think through sort of, even with all the laws and that we can imagine passing, we still live in a country where there are more guns than people. And the idea of like mass gun confiscation, I don't think anybody thinks that that's feasible.
That's not.
And so then that raises the question of how do we learn to live with guns? Mm-hmm. And that's what these groups are actually doing. They're doing that hard frontline labor. And I mean, and so I think that that's where. There's a lot of movement actually in terms of thinking very creatively about how to actually address this issue and address it in a way that is that puts people at the center.
It's interesting because we often hear everybody they're when these incidents happen with mass shootings, oh my goodness, we send our prayers, or others folks are saying, you know, we've got to do something. Well, you've just hit on an area that's really been lacking, and that's how to work with trauma survivors.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's something that can be done.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and
in
that's
a positive manner, right?
Yeah, and that's something that's really powerful about these groups is that, you know, there's one group in Oakland, California, where, and I mean, many groups do these things. I'm just thinking of specific examples of, you know, they're actually in hospitals, like, you know, right as soon as possible, trying to provide trauma-informed services to victims and survivors, both to help with that process of living through gun violence, but also to reduce the possibility of retaliation in the aftermath. And so, you know, it really is a trauma-centered approach. That being said, though, there's new research coming out that very much shows that if we want to support the people who are doing this work, we also have to recognize that it is traumatizing for them. They report very high levels of, PTSD-related symptoms, even higher than on some metrics, higher than public law enforcement. And so I think, you know, shifting, this is why I actually think it's really powerful to shift the conversation to include gun violence, but shift it to gun trauma, because I think that gives us a much richer and more, I think that really gets at how this impacts people and impacts people beyond the immediate victims.
What are you looking at next for your career? I know you've got this book coming out. What areas would you like to further study?
Yeah, so my the research that I'm doing right now is actually on gun violence survivors. And so I'm interviewing gun violence survivors who have experienced gun violence in a wide variety of forms, from, you know, survivors of intimate partner gun violence to mass shootings to community gun violence. And so that's sort of my, you know, the next set of the next research that I'm really focusing on. And then, you know, the other piece that I'm also working on is, you know, it's, as we kind of open this conversation, there's been sort of a need for sociologists and social scientists to be more involved in this research. I think that, you know, no matter how great we might design gun laws, no matter how many conversations we might have about what the Second Amendment really means, it's really how the rubber hits the road, how this matters to everyday people. That's what we need to better understand, and that's what sociologists and social scientists do. So figuring out ways to kind of broaden that conversation is really at the top of my agenda.
Dr. Jennifer Carlson, thank you, Jennifer.
Thank you. Thank you
so much.
Jennifer
Carlson, winner of the prestigious 2022 MacArthur Fellowship for her work examining gun politics, culture, and trauma in the United States. Our one-on-one presented by Moe's Gallery and Fine Framing, Fort Lowell and Dodge, and at moesgallery.com. Take a break. Be right back.
Dine in or take out authentic Neapolitan wood-fired pizza at Vero Amore, where every flavorful pizza, pasta, and panini are homemade using the finest local and imported ingredients. Vero Amore, Plaza Palomino at Swan and Fort Lowell, and on Dove Mountain in Marana, plus a full catering menu and mobile pizza truck for parties and events. Vero Amore, on the web at veroamorepizza.com.
Cushman & Wakefield PICOR is Tucson's leading independently owned full-service commercial real estate company. Founded in 1985, Cushman & Wakefield PICOR offers leasing, sales, and property management for industrial, office, medical, retail, land, and investment properties in Tucson and Sonora, Mexico. Visit our website at PICOR.com for the latest news from Tucson's commercial real estate sector. That's PICOR.com. Call us at 748-7100.
The Friends of Pima Animal Care Center is the nonprofit partner to our Pima County Animal Shelter. We grant critically needed resources to PACC so that it can continue the amazing life-saving progress it has made in recent years. Your generosity helps us find homes for abused, neglected, and abandoned animals at PAC. Learn how you can help at friendsofpacc.org.
Hi, this is Irene Coppola, President and CEO of the Better Business Bureau serving Southern Arizona. The BBB sets the standards for marketplace trust by engaging with and educating consumers and businesses. The BBB is the resource to turn to for the objective, unbiased information on businesses offering national and local consumer services online and in person. Learn more about the many services offered by the Better Business Bureau at bbb.org.
As a small business owner, I appreciate the services of a top-notch certified public accountant. That's why Michael C. Flowers of Flowers, Rieger & Associates is the CPA firm of the Buckmaster Show. Michael's a former Small Business Leader of the Year in Tucson. He'll professionally handle all of your accounting needs and tax preparation services. Flowers, Rieger & Associates, 6125 East Grant Road, and on the web, flowersrieger.com.
Have you always wanted to cruise to Alaska? If that's the case, then you'll only see the tip of the iceberg. At Bon Voyage Travel, we can package the full Alaska experience with a cruise tour. Journey to Denali National Park on glass-domed rail cars. Tour the tundra wilderness and see the northern lights with an expert guide. And of course, relax on your cruise as you enjoy the glaciers up close and personal. Go to bvtravel.com today. Bon Voyage Travel, your Alaska experts.
Welcome back. It is the Buckmaster Show. First day of spring. Great day to go over to the Green Things location at 3384 East River Road by the Rito River, just west of the Brandy Fenton Parks. Think about, not only think about, but act on doing your spring planting. 13-acre site at Green Things has everything you need for the garden and for garden accessories. Their sister business, Zocalo and Zocalo Village. 5 shops there, some beautiful merchandise, Talavera pottery, handcrafted dining room sets out of some great woods like mesquite. Anyway, it's a great site. 3384 East River Road, greenthingsaz.com, and the sister business, ZocaloVillage.com, and they're open daily, 53rd year of business. When we do our telephone interviews, which we will be doing next, our live line presented by Rincon Ventures, Real Estate and Property Management. Let's go now on the live line. Dr. Matt Hines, he works as a hospitalist at Tucson Medical Center. He represents, as a Democrat, District 2 on the Pima County Board of Supervisors. Dr. Hines, how are you?
I'm doing well, Bill. Thanks for asking. Good to be here.
Well, I was thinking about you when I was reading the Wall Street Journal weekend edition over the weekend. Dr. Tom Frieden had an op-ed piece. He was a one-time director of the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention from 2009 to 2017. I'm sure you know him, or maybe you know him personally.
Yeah, he was there when I was working for the Obama administration, absolutely.
There you go. He oversaw the responses to H1N1 influenza, Ebola, and Zika epidemics. The bottom line with this article, and the reason I was thinking of you, is you took a lot of heat, and so did Dr. Cullen, not only before, when she was bringing this up in Pima County, but then when she went before state lawmakers about her protocols and the protocols that you advocated for. The bottom line with right. Dr. Frieden was millions of lives, Dr. Hines, were saved by masks and closures and vaccines, but millions more Absolutely. Were needlessly lost. Your thoughts?
Correct. Absolutely. And I said this at the time, and under fire from a lot of people that still show up to our meetings and scream at us about policy that hasn't even been enforced for over a year. But it's true. We lost in Arizona thousands and thousands of people needlessly because we had not just lack of leadership from people like Governor Ducey, but almost like just a flippancy, an irreverence or even just, forget science, do what you want. You can't let people tell you what to do. And none of us wanted to have any of these policies, but we also didn't want to have piles of corpses or refrigerated grocery store trucks to augment morgue capacity, which we had in Arizona as well, as you know. And needlessly lost lives. And that's thanks to Governor Ducey. In Pima County, because of Dr. Cullen's leadership and the policies that our board advocated for and implemented for much of the pandemic, we didn't lose as many lives, thank God. But I appreciate the fact that Dr. Frieden wrote that, and I, of course, would agree with it.
Well, let's face it, Dr. Hines, Dr. Cullen was treated very poorly by the state lawmakers when she went before them in her confirmation hearing to become the Arizona Health Director.
I think you're incredibly diplomatic. They behaved like children. They behaved like immature little children fighting over a shovel in the sandbox. Like, they sounded like four-year-olds. I mean, just disgusting behavior. And I was in the legislature, as you know, for 4 years, from 2009 to 2013, and it was very partisan. It was, frankly, for two of those years, there was a 2-to-1 margin of Republicans to Democrats. And even still, I could get bills heard. I could have respectful discussions with not all, but most of my Republican colleagues and some who I consider still friends to this day. I don't understand what these people are all about. They don't seem to clearly want to be, they're not behaving like statesmen and stateswomen. They just aren't. And they really, I mean, they should think about what it is that they want to do with their lives, because it doesn't seem like legislating is truly of interest to them, just making political points.
Well, I'll tell you that, Dr. Cullen, the state's loss is our gain, because we keep Dr. Cullen. I think she does a terrific job. And if there was ever somebody that was qualified to be the state health director, it was Dr. Cullen, with all of her experience in Washington.
Totally. And she knows Dr. Frieden, you know, they're on a first-name texting basis, right? So that's so many things. And we in the county have benefited from that through grants. Through all sorts of things that she's been able to bring to the health department that no other person in that position would have been able to do without those connections. And I will say, Pima County is being incredibly well served by Dr. Cullen. I'm delighted that she's going to stay with us. And I would also remind everyone that we have as the head, as our CEO, Jan Lesher, our county administrator, ran the state of Arizona under Napolitano, and for, I believe, 4 years, she ran the Department of Homeland Security.
Yep.
Okay, a massive, massive federal agency, which is a conglomeration of 20-something other agencies, many of whom did not like working together very well and had just kind of been formed, right, or relatively recently. So we have a very talented group of people working for us in Pima County. It is unlike, I would say, almost any other county in the nation.
All right, let's talk about your op-ed in the Arizona Daily Star. I'm going to let you explain to our listeners what you were hoping to accomplish with the op-ed yesterday. And for people have probably heard that you've been the object of some very distasteful comments and accusations at the Pima County board meetings. Go ahead and explain to our listeners what this is all about.
Certainly. And it was just time to say something, you know, and that's been, you know, after my friend who I was on a trip with made an accidental cameo during one of our public board meetings, that turned into some really disgusting, what I believe to be hate speech, the way it developed and continued to develop at our meetings. And that is, of course, people showing up and basically, in some cases, screaming at me or at the board that I'm somehow a pedophile, which is a terrible accusation, unfounded, not true, no proof of that at all. And also, they just kept showing up. And it really didn't seem to be all that much about proving a particular criminal activity or behavior, but it became very clear that it was much more about using that word, which is, by the way, something that could be triggering for children or former children who actually were victims or survived such atrocious behaviors. And that became sort of a substitute. You know, it became pretty clear that it was a form of hate speech and being leveled at me, not because they had proof of any kind of crime, but because it was convenient and a way to call me out, separate me, and basically to point out the fact that I happen to be a gay man. And that really needs to be called out for what it is. And that's what I wanted to do in the Star.
Well, how have the meetings been going lately? Have there been changes in the call to the audience? And you're not advocating, Dr. Matt Hines, that there should be no public input.
No, of course. We welcome that. All of us do. And many times people have come forward and brought items that we were not aware of. We're not allowed by state law to talk about something that is presented to us on the day of the meeting, because that does not allow anyone else who might be listening. We need to have advance notice. That's the open meeting law. But I welcome call to the public. That, basically an hour and a half of county government meetings have turned into extremist, almost political rally-like situation. We have 25, 30 people showing up, cheering for each other, clapping, and sometimes they'll stay. And if a board member says something they just don't like, they just jeer at you. I'm like, wait a minute, this isn't really it's not audience participation for the whole meeting. It's you get 3 minutes to speak to hopefully bring to light an issue or a couple of issues that you're concerned about. And yes, we understand that it's a board of four Democrats, sort of, and one Republican, and there's going to be a lot of folks that disagree with us, maybe just politically. And people are welcome to come and share that they don't agree with us politically or with past decisions we've made, such as masking or other things like that, vaccine policy. That's fine too. But the way in which it's being done, not just the particular hate speech quality that I called out, but is turning it into such a disruptive thing for county government. And it's an hour and a half or sometimes close to 2 hours that we don't do any government business. And it is it's a terrible waste of staff time. And it makes no sense at all. And I would look, there's just a better way to do this. And so, no, I'm not advocating for no call to the public, though it's not required in law, by the way. I do think that we can do this in a better way and we can be more respectful. Perhaps, for example, we could have it at the end instead of at the beginning, because that way you don't have Laura Conover, the county attorney, waiting around for 5.5 hours one meeting because of how raucous and disruptful and disrespectful these calls to the public sessions have gone. And unfortunately, over the 2 years of the pandemic, I think some of these folks just got used to kind of doing what they wanted. And they were never really called out or penalized by the last our previous chair, unfortunately. So they got into some behavior patterns that were really not good ones to foster or to really countenance. So I'm hopeful that we can make this work better and it's I think in some cases kind of terrifying for people who just want to show up and say, hey, I got a letter from the county. I think it's really strange that you would ask me to give up my potbelly pig pet, which a lady actually did come to do that. Those people kind of look around like, what's going on? Where am I? So the way the call to the public has devolved, I believe, is actually potentially suppressing speech for others who would want to show up and bring up points like that.
Yeah, because, I mean, there may be some people that say, I'd rather just avoid going to the county altogether, to the meetings, because
right.
I don't want to sit
right.
through that. I don't want to hear all that and this and all the fighting. Who needs it?
Sure.
Anyway, let's pause right here. We've got a lot more here on my agenda, county stuff that we'll get into with Dr. Matt Hines right after this.
Tucson's original gastropub, Noble Hops in Oro Valley, proudly announces a second Tucson area location where you'll enjoy locally brewed craft beer and gastropub fine fare. Order in or take out at Noble Hops, a pub for foodies, on West Lambert Lane at North La Cañada Drive in Oro Valley, and now at the Doubletree Hotel on Alvernon across from Tucson's Reed Park. More on the web at noblehops.com.
At Tucson International Airport, we are nonstop for our community. Our main priorities are providing a safe and secure travel experience and excellent customer service. We are also nonstop for landing prosperity in Southern Arizona by attracting new flights for business travel and family getaways. When your airport thrives, our community thrives. So fly local, fly TUS. Tucson International Airport is nonstop for Tucson.
The Regional Transportation Authority plan is funded by a voter-approved half-cent sales tax. The RTA tax is collected throughout Pima County and averages about $100 million in revenue each month. The RTA is the largest annual funder of regional transportation projects in the region. The RTA tax funds priority projects that were approved by voters in 2006. See details in the latest RTA annual report at rtamobility.com.
The Green Valley News and Sarita Sun cover two of Arizona's most desirable communities. The newspapers reach more than 75% of the communities each week, with a combined population of more than 50,000. The Green Valley News also publishes a dozen magazines each year, and both newspapers publish up-to-the-minute local news online at gvnews.com. The Green Valley News and Sarita Sun, it's all right here.
Nestled in the foothills of the Santa Rita Mountains of southeastern Arizona is Equine Voices and Sanctuary, home to horses and burros that were rescued from neglect, abuse, abandonment, and slaughter. Please consider Equine Voices Rescue and Sanctuary with a financial gift of support and estate remembrance. Learn more about our vision and values at equinevoices.org.
Are you happy with the news you get? While not all news is good news, you know good reporting when you see it. Check TucsonSentinel.com every day for breaking news and investigative reports. Have your say in the comments. It's all in TucsonSentinel.com, your local, independent, nonprofit news. You can rely on TucsonSentinel.com for solid reporting about immigration, Tucson and penal politics, everything from the border to baseball. It's independent news without the spin. TucsonSentinel.com. We are watching Tucson.
Hi, this is Tom Sullivan. Join me weeknights from 7 to 10 for the Tom Sullivan Show on 1030 KVOI, The Voice.
Welcome back. It is the Buckmaster Show. Bill Buckmaster with you. Silver City in Grant County, New Mexico would make a great spring getaway. It's only about a three-hour drive. I would suggest looking at their website, southwestnewmexico.org, before you jump in the car or truck or on the motorcycle and head east. You will find all sorts of wonderful recreation activities, including hiking in the Gila National Wilderness. Again, the website, southwestnewmexico.org. We continue now with our conversation with Dr. Matt Hines, Democrat representing the 2nd Supervisorial District on the 5-member board, Pima County Board of Supervisors. Okay, Dr. Hines, we've got assessed valuations seem to be going up. We will be having, let's see, Wednesday at 12:30, the Pima County Assessor will be joining us for her take on all of this. What is your take? Are we looking at a tax increase here or what?
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear just a part of that because of some music, but what was the first part of the question?
Well, I was saying that assessed valuations have been going up, and we're going to have the Pima County Assessor with us at 12:30 to give her take on this. And sure. Are we looking at perhaps a property tax increase? And I know it is limited what you and your colleagues could do. I think you can't really go more than a 5% increase.
That's correct. And so two kind of ways of looking at this. One, as property values change, that, you know, increasing, that does change, of course, the assessed value, which has an impact on your individual tax bill. From the county perspective, though, the last five cycles, we have actually voted to continue a gradual decrease in terms of that property tax assessment overall when you're looking at the primary and secondary combined. So that is something that, in terms of the assessed tax rate. Now, obviously, as the assessed value of the homes change and go up, then that could still potentially mean an increase in an individual's property tax bill, but from the county perspective, we have been consistently working to actually gradually decrease that overall combined property tax rate over the past 5 years, and I believe that's going to be something we continue to do.
But federal dollars are starting to go away in May, so then the concern is how are we going to fund things that may come up, emergencies and so on.
Oh, sure. It's been a very, as Chuck Huckleberry, our previous county administrator, said, he'd never seen this much money in the coffers from the feds, for sure, because a lot of that, most of that actually COVID-related. So it's not like going away and getting clawed back, you know, instantaneously. This is something that certain buckets of money have particular I don't want to say expiration dates, but we have to encumber or use funds for approved projects based on that particular bucket of funds by a specific time. In some cases, it's 2026 or 2024, and so they're not, you know, the feds aren't coming to like to sweep our bank accounts, you know, a couple of months or anything like that. But we do have to make sure that those funds are properly encumbered and expended by the time that the Feds have, the U.S. Department of Treasury has told us. So, in terms of other projects, we have to look to other sources of funding. We can certainly ask the voters on specific issues to, like we did with the RTA back in 2006, they're, depending on the issue, we can put it forward to the voters to see if they are interested in funding particular projects. And typically there is a balance, an ending balance, and that's pretty significant at the end of every budget cycle that does allow us some ability, for emergency situations to have some extra funds to dedicate if necessary.
The feeling is that our homeless population is growing. I don't know if it is, whether there's been any kind of homeless census that confirms that, but it is something that many feel it needs to be the front burner issue right now. What are your thoughts?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Oh, it absolutely is. And I, because of the pandemic, there hasn't been, typically there's an annual there's an annual count that hasn't happened for several years now. I believe it is now going to be happening again. If that hasn't already happened, it will be soon. So that will give us some idea as to where we are in terms of that population. But just anecdotally, in terms of my own experience, I live downtown. So I believe I'm seeing a higher proportion of the population in our unhoused community. And that is something that is absolutely needs to be a central role for the county to address. We've had some groups have formed actually to specifically advocate for addressing issues surrounding our homeless population and how that affects folks' ability to operate their businesses and live and all that. And I agree. I think that we need to work as much as we can across all the jurisdictions in the county to work on, in general, more affordable housing. But in specific for the unhoused population, they can, I think, tremendously benefit from expenditures at the county level and others that work to really just optimize programs for them, help with making sure that they can get housed in some ways. And in some cases, the Housing First model, which is one I'm very excited about, we have proven that model that works really well in Pima County through a grant program that we implemented, I think, about two to three years ago. It shows us, in fact, people that have been simply given a house, even if they are, for example, addicted to something, meth, whatever, they have a place, they have a key, they know it's theirs, they can put their stuff there and go to an inpatient treatment facility for, say, a month and get clean, and they know their stuff is still there. And just having that basic, necessity there, all of a sudden they can focus on work. They can focus on training or retraining. They can focus on employment, and they can get jobs. And in some cases, they moved out of the housing that was provided to them. Hey, thanks, I'm good now. And they left. And that's great. You know, that wasn't even the goal of the program. So working toward getting some of these unhoused folks in our community housing just without judgment, without a rule that they have to be Christian or Catholic within 2 weeks of moving in, which is disgusting. I'm sorry, I can't believe that's actually a thing. Just saying, hey, you're in a bad place. We don't want you on the street for a lot of reasons. It's bad for you. It's bad for the community. And we want to see if this is something that can help you. That program works, and I think we should expand it to the best of our ability.
All right, Matt Hines. Dr. Hines, thanks for visiting with us. We'll catch up with you next month, I hope. Thanks.
Appreciate it, Bill. Thank you. Bye now.
All right. That'll do it for the Buckmaster Show as we kick off not only a new week, but we are into spring and still kind of feels winterish, doesn't it? Some of those 30-degree temperatures are going to reemerge, I guess, this week. So that's good. Holds off on the real hot weather, maybe a little bit longer. On behalf of John Engineering and producing the show, Bill Buckmaster saying, hope you have a great weekend.